I'll call to order the House Committee on Environment and Water, and we are beginning today, committee members, with an informational meeting on water issues in the Umatilla Basin. We'll spend about a half an hour on that before we turn to a public hearing on House Bill 2406. So let me open the informational meeting on water issues in the Umatilla, and we've asked a few folks to provide an overview of what's going on in the Umatilla related to water. So Barry Norris, Mike Wick, Dennis Doherty, and Bill Quimps, if you would, I know we only have three chairs up here, but if the four of you could find a way to maybe add a chair. There we go. That'll work. And gentlemen, we have about a half an hour allotted to this. It's the four of you. I think you've talked to each other about timing, or hopefully have talked to each other on timing, but we're going to try to keep it pretty limited. But I'm going to leave it to you to figure out how to spend the half an hour, knowing that we're going to want to interact with you, so reserving some time for questions. So,
okay.
And I've got one right after you, so
great. Good afternoon, Mr. Chair. I'm Barry Norris with the Oregon Water Resources Department, and I'm going to show you just a little bit about the...
You pull the mic, just angle the mic towards you. I think it doesn't need to be much, but there you go.
Is that better?
Yep.
I'll talk to you just for a few minutes about the existing project and about where it's headed. The project is, of course, located in north central Oregon, and it's that area that's shaded in kind of a reddish color, north central part of the state. There are four critical groundwater areas. These critical groundwater areas started in 1976 and 1990. This area here is more of a close-up of the area. Critical groundwater areas were in response to a declining water table of 400-plus feet and less water for the irrigators to use. This gives you kind of a tabulation. A lot of numbers here, but I've circled what's important. There are over 190,000 acre-feet of groundwater allotted by water right permit in the area, but only 63,000 are allowed because of the declining water levels over there. So they're only allowed to use about 30% of what's allotted to them for groundwater use for the irrigation activities. This is a close-up of the area again. There are two critical groundwater areas here, alluvium material and basalt. The ordinance, Butter Creek basalt and Stage Gulch basalt. Here's where the freeway runs through it. The two areas that I want to pay particular attention to are an area in here, which is a County Line Improvement District project, and then an area over in here, which is Echo Meadows. Those are important to the project. This, of course, is all in... the project is for an investigation of below-ground storage using wintertime water out of the Columbia River when it's available. This is a cross-section of the area. Pay attention to line AA. It's a map of the area, and if you look at it in cross-section, you can see that alluvium material overlies the basalt. The project proposes to store water in both the alluvium material and the basalts. And it's going to use the alluvium material for not only storage, but also to clean the water and also for return flows to the Umatilla River. Now, this is what the basalts would look like underground. This is a nice slide because it shows you as the basalt layers are laid down over the years, it penetrates into the contact layers where the water is contained very slowly in vertical. So you can see that the recharge of those areas is very slow, but the contacts between these layers of basalt has plentiful water unless it's overused, which has been the case in these critical areas. Now, this is how the project will work, spreading the water over the alluvium material. It filters down through the sands and gravels into the alluvial aquifer system, and then the other option is to inject through a well down into one of those contact areas between the basalt layers, another aquifer. Now, there are a number of different aquifers, so there'll be target basalt aquifers. This is a map of the area again, and it shows all the existing infrastructure, which is important to the project. The lines in red are all the pipelines, the pumping stations along the Columbia River. The blue lines or purple lines are the canal system. And so the project is taking a look at how all of that existing infrastructure will be taken used as part of the project, bring water from the Columbia down into the critical areas and spread in the alluvium, then taken back out of the alluvium and down into the basalts. One of the primary systems is this system right here. It's the Columbia Improvement District. It's a pumping station on the Columbia. It brings water down through a pipeline to a canal where it's distributed now out to the system. Another part of that system is used by the Boardman Tree Farm. And it's in right in this area here is the Columbia Improvement District's alluvial aquifer system allowing water to infiltrate into the alluvium at this time. More of a schematic, the deep basalt aquifer, the county line improvement district's shallow alluvial aquifer, the Echo Meadows shallow alluvial aquifer, the deep basalt or stage gulch basalt aquifer, and the Butter Creek aquifer, basalt aquifer. The criteria for selecting an artificial recharge site is the hydrogeology, which is very, very good out in this area for this type of a project. Proximity to infrastructure. I showed you all of the existing infrastructure, which can be modified and added to make the project a success. Land use and land ownership is important. Proximity to areas of most need. Obviously, there's a lot of need because it's a critical groundwater area. And the opportunity for environmental benefits, which are also part of this project. Very good opportunities for return flows to the Umatilla River. Now here's how the existing two projects might work. The county line is an existing AR site. It runs water out through an existing canal and infiltrates into the system. There are about 6,000 acre feet of water that's recharged to that site right now. An additional, it's got potentially room for 100,000 acre feet. About 75 acre feet per additional foot of elevation could be utilized bringing water from the Columbia River. So there's a lot of storage, return flow opportunity to the Umatilla River, and of course it overlies the critical basalt aquifers. Same with Echo Meadows, although the storage opportunities aren't quite as good, it has opportunity for cleaning the water to water quality standards and also return flows to the Umatilla River. So those are the two primary alluvium aquifer systems that are being investigated as part of this project. Now, essentially, the project works like this. You take water out of the Columbia River, put it into an alluvium aquifer, take it out of the alluvium aquifer during the irrigation season and use it for irrigation, or run it over and inject it into a deep basalt aquifer for storage during the winter. You can take it out of the basalt aquifer during the irrigation season and use it for irrigation. Also, some of this flow naturally returns to the Umatilla River for inflow benefits. The target water budget for this project was made up like this, to be 100,000 acre feet with 68,000, or roughly half of the amount of water that is in deficit in that critical area. Now, this is just a target for the consultants to come up with a conceptual project that can be built. About 6,000 acre feet will stay in the basalt aquifer for recharge, another 100,000 acre feet for exempt wells, and then a Umatilla flow augmentation about 24,000 acre feet per year for 99,000 acre feet, bringing 99,000 acre feet from the Columbia River over to run it through the system. This is option one, which would be the provide a 25,000 acre feet in supply and storage a year for a distribution of about 16,000 acre feet. It would use the Columbia Improvement District's pipeline and canal system that's there already. You'd need to winterize the pump station and pipeline, bring it down into the canal, and then build a new pipeline up into the County Line Improvement District area to run it out over the sands and gravels to infiltrate into the aquifer. The aquifer would then provide storage as well as cleaning the water to water quality standards, which could then be injected through a system of wells down into the basalt aquifer. Now another, and then you could pick that up out of some wells out of the alluvium, run it down into these areas for injection into the basalts, and then picked up during the irrigation season by the farmers, and that would cost about $22 million to do that. Full build out of the west side of the critical area project is about $100 million. It would provide 100,000 acre feet, so about for the project, of what about 60,000 acre-foot would be for recovery and the distribution. The rest would go toward return flows to the Umatilla system to resupply and build up the water levels in the basalt aquifer again and for other miscellaneous uses. This would be about $100 million. The cost for these projects is about $1,000 per acre-foot as opposed to a surface water storage site, which could be $4,000, $5,000, or $6,000 per acre-foot. So it's very, very cost-beneficial. The ratio is very, very good for these kinds of projects when you have the right conditions. And this is the right condition in this area. It's a viable project. We've got the coalition on board. Everybody's on board for doing this. So that's a very rapid run-through. Any questions?
Yes, Representative Bernhardt.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Some of these questions may be off the topic, and if they are, let's skip them. But you referred several times, over and over again, to the issue of cleaning, to the issue of restore of water flow in the Umatilla River, and to the issue of the buildup of the water supply. I don't know enough about any of these issues to understand them. I don't know whether this is the right panel to ask these kinds of questions of.
I think you should go ahead and ask your questions.
Okay. Describe cleaning for us for a minute and how it would work and how you would prevent the buildup of whatever it is you're cleaning out of the water from eventually wrecking your aquifer.
Mr. Chair, Representative, the alluvium aquifers would be used for three different reasons. One would be to store water for irrigation during the irrigation season. Another would be for return flows to the Umatilla River to augment stream flow. And the third would be to clean the water to water quality standards. We found through investigation and testing on the project that as you run Umatilla River water or Columbia River water out over the alluvium, let it infiltrate down through the sands and gravels, and let it move through the system for a matter of weeks, actually, that it cleans it to water quality standards. Now, the water has to meet water quality standards before you can inject it into the basalt aquifer. Oregon terms basalt water as drinking water, and therefore any water that you put into the basalt aquifer has to meet water quality, EPA, drinking water quality standards. So it does that. And it has an added benefit, I might add, is flushing out the system. So as pesticides and fertilizers and things have built up over the years in the soils, this actually dilutes and flushes the system, so it's got that added benefit as well.
Let me
go ahead,
refine my question. When I have a filter in my drinking supply in my refrigerator, every once in a while I have to take that one out and put a new one in because something accumulates in there. If I have an air filter, the same thing happens. I either have to clean the filter or replace it. How does this system work in this kind of filtration, and how are we going to avoid moving billions of cubic yards of dirt in order to replace the filter? Do you understand the kind of question I'm trying to ask?
Mr. Chair.
How does this thing renew itself, or does it renew itself? Are we eventually going to have a salt flat here because we have run a lot of water through it to filter it?
Mr. Chair.
What should we expect?
Mr. Chair, Representative, it shouldn't accumulate. It won't accumulate. It'll flush through the system. The Columbia River water is, by irrigation standards, pretty clean water.
Yeah.
So it's not like we're bringing in a bunch of silt or some type of large enough particles that will clog the system. It cleans it to drinking water standards, and it also will flush through the system and will last for as long as we want it to last.
I have to get some other information to answer the question I'm trying to ask. I'm not able to ask it accurately.
Mr. Chair, Representative, let me. I'm not qualified well enough to give you a good technical answer to that, and probably none of the panel members are as well.
If I may, let me put it a different way. This looks like a fabulous idea, but a brute force response. And what little bit I know, I understand, and not which is much about the way natural systems work, is that we can overload natural systems pretty easily. I want to know that we're not going to overload this one and destroy its capacity to clean the water. And I'd like to have some sense as to why. I'm completely ignorant of this process and this system, but I can learn things pretty fast. So it would be helpful to me if somebody who does know how this system works, if they could get some information to us about that.
Let me suggest that we follow up offline about that question. I suspect that the entire committee would be interested in hearing more about that particular issue. Noting that we have only 15 minutes left with this panel, I want to make sure we're able to hear from the other folks. Did you want to follow up?
My last question is, talk a little bit about the Umatilla River and why it's a benefit that we're recharging it.
Well, Mr. Chair, Representative, it's a benefit because there have been two projects and a third one on the books to return flow into the Umatilla River for fish flows and for other aquatic needs. Because the river is fully appropriated, it has been fully appropriated. So
okay,
currently,
that answers
your question.
Thank you, Mr.
Yes, sir.
Chair.
Representative.
One of the things, that if I might, the Umatilla River, just a point of illustration, for 75 years, was the salmon runs in the river were extinct. Not endangered, not threatened, extinct. Is that correct? And they were extinct because of the low river runs and a varieties of other reasons. Through the works that have taken place previously, the tribes, the hard work of the tribes and the cooperation of the community there, they have restored the run of water in the river. And in the process of doing that, then the hard work of the tribes, they have restored the salmon run in the Umatilla River. Now, part of the goal, haven't talked about, but I'm sure part of the goal is to even increase that run. There is a fishery now on the Umatilla. I don't know how many fish, it varies from year to year, that are allowed, part of which are reserved for tribal use and part of which are open to the public at large, sort of thing. So part of what they're talking about as far as the river is already has a significant history of success that has taken place through the efforts of the two groups.
And having visited... Having visited that fishery and seen those beautiful salmon making their way up that river that for decades, as you note, Representative Jensen, it had no fish, had no migrating salmon, it's really a spectacular sight and does speak to the work that's happened out in that basin.
My home, Mr. Chair, excuse me, I have a picture of a... young man who happened to be my grandson that just caught a 25-pounder out of there. So.
Wow.
That's amazing. let's move on. And thank you very much, Mr. Norris, for your testimony. And whoever's next.
Thank you. I've been asked to do a quick history of the critical groundwater problem in the Umatilla Basin, and some of the slides that Barry did are
you,
a little...
Sorry, could you introduce yourself for the record?
I'm sorry. My name is Mike Wick. I'm the district manager for Westland Irrigation District. And just to do a quick geographic reference, I put this on here. Obviously, we're here in Salem, and we're talking about this area over here in Umatilla and Morrow County. This is the same slide that Barry showed, just the Umatilla Basin. Again, Morrow County, Umatilla County, Umatilla River coming down. A quick history of some of the groundwater events. First recorded groundwater irrigation well, 1925. This, from right in here, is really some of the key elements of this slide. Early 60s and 70s, a lot of groundwater development occurred in the area. A lot of center pivots came in. A lot of crops were able to be grown in the desert. And with the result of the critical groundwater areas being declared by the state because of declining groundwater levels. Similar slide to what Barry showed, again, the areas and their dates of declaration. This is an overview of the four areas with a aerial view, and the light blue here is Umatilla River. The dark blue is the Westland Irrigation District Canal System, and I'll show you a little bit more detail of what Barry talked about of county line recharge and what some of the issues they had. This is a slide showing one of the wells from the ordinance shallow aquifer area, and you can see that in the 50s and 60s, the depth to water, which is just basically how far down below the ground would you go before you could find water, was about 60 feet. With this development of groundwater areas, wells and so forth, and center pivots, that groundwater got chased down. And you can see right here at about 1976, 77, it was about 85 feet below ground. And since that time, you can see it's recovered somewhat since about 1977 to allow those folks within this ordinance area to continue to pump and grow their crops. And the reason behind that was that they formed what they call the County Line Water Improvement District, and were able to partner with Westland to deliver winter water to them. And we deliver on an average about 6,000 acre feet a year to County Line through our system. We divert out of the Umatilla during the winter time. As a matter of fact, we've been delivering water to them this winter already. Comes down through here and to the end of this part of our system, where they have put in this red line indicates a buried pipeline, and runs water through this pipeline into an open canal system and over into a kind of a collection area for this amount of water for those guys to replenish their wells. That's been going on since 1977, an average of about 6,000 acre feet every winter that Westland delivers to County Line. And it's shown to be a practical and worthwhile methodology of being able to recover some of the aquifers that were quite severely lowered. Barry showed this slide again. Again, the important part is that compared to what the groundwater rights are, the sustainable annual yield for these areas results in a shortfall of almost two-thirds on average. So of those total acre feet of water rights, only about one-third of those acre feet are able to be utilized because of the sustainable annual yield. So we talked about the Umatilla Basin Aquifer Restoration Project. Obviously, it was a feasibility study to store water, shallow aquifers in County Line and Echo Meadows, and the basalt in Ordinance, Butter Creek, and Stage Gulch. And with the idea that we would use existing infrastructure as much as possible and add on as needed. Again, a replay of the slide that Barry showed, but the important part again is that the relative distance from the end of the CID pipeline over into the County Line Water Improvement Collection Area makes it pretty feasible to get water there. And the contractor that was hired by Water Resources Department to do this initial phase of the aquifer recovery study assessment, as Barry mentioned, has indicated that this particular area has a large capacity for additional storage beyond the 6,000 we're delivering from the Umatilla. So, quickly, next steps. Obviously, we want to get the aquifer recovery assessment completed. The contractor is due to have their full report to Water Resources by the end of June. And we continue to coordinate with the local stakeholders in the basin. Commissioner Doherty will speak on the Umatilla Basin Water Coalition that's recently formed. And we're obviously in support of the $2.5 million that's in the governor's recommended budget to allow the recovery project study to continue on and eventually reach full build out. So I know we're a little short of time, so I just kind of ran through those pretty fast.
Thanks. And let's go ahead and move on to Commissioner Doherty, to our county elected official. Thanks for making the trip to Salem today. Go ahead.
Chair Cannon, members of the committee. Dennis Doherty, Umatilla County Commissioner. I will forego the historical part that I would love to share with you when we have more time. I want you to know that we do have a formal coalition within the basin, and the composition of that coalition would include the two governing bodies of Morrill and Umatilla counties, the ports of Umatilla and Morrill counties, six irrigation districts, and the Umatilla Electric Cooperative. We have a 20-plus year history of collaborating in our basin to address our water supply needs. It's not that we're not also interested and care about water quality, but our focus at this point is water supply. What you have here is a Umatilla recharge project that was and is still being studied with the $750,000 that the legislature authorized in the short session in 2008 under Senate Bill 1069. All signs at this point indicate that we're going to see the public and private benefits that we expected, in some cases maybe to a greater degree than we expected. What we are talking about is a long-term strategy, an integrated strategy to use existing infrastructure, hold down the cost, spend a lot less than would be required for an above-ground storage system, and build into it what you would call a public-private benefit, public-private partnership arrangement. I'll leave it at that for today.
Great. Thank you. Mr. Quimps, it's an honor to have you here from the Umatilla Tribes. Thank you, and go ahead.
Chairman Cannon, members of the committee, Representative Jensen, it's an honor to be here with you. For the record, my name is William Quimps. I'm a member of the Board of Trustees, governing body of the Umatilla Indian Reservation, Confederated Tribes, and I'm here to represent the board. We're very fortunate to have the history of the Umatilla Basin Project as a foundation for us to continue to build on its legacies. That foundation is one of unparalleled collaboration and far-reaching success. Thanks to the vision and fortitude of the likes of the late Stafford Hansel, the late Hadley Akins, Anton Minthorn, the current chairman of the Board of Trustees of the tribe, and Bob Levy of Westland Irrigation District, we have the privilege of coming before you today to ask for your assistance and your counsel to move our basin even farther toward water supply certainty in balance with our environmental protection. In the Umatilla, we base success on the bounty of our restored salmon runs and the certainty of water supply for the two counties that supply more agricultural food crops than anywhere else in Oregon. 20 years ago, Chairman Cannon, you suffered a century defined by a dry channel dewatered by irrigation and a complete loss of all three stocks of salmon. In 1998, after 10 years of nearly impossible negotiations by the leaders I named a few minutes ago, the collaboration culminated in the Umatilla Basin Project Act, passed by Congress and then constructed over a six-year period. As a result of that collaboration, flows were partially restored to the Umatilla River, allowing fallen spring chinook and coho salmon to be reintroduced and recovered. Today, rather than a water war pitting tribes against irrigators, we have strong salmon runs with a fishery for spring chinook every year. Even surface water irrigators have a water supply more certain and predictable than they did before. But our basin is not done. We lack a tribal water rights settlement desperately needed so that the Confederated Tribes can have a water supply as well. Though we are the most senior residents in the basin, we're the only ones without a water right. The over 100 farms in the lower basin which have exhausted the groundwater supply they rely on also need a new water supply to keep them productive. I believe with the leadership of Commissioner Doherty, the tribe, and the others before you today, we can get both. The tribal government supports the governor's request for $2.5 million of lottery-backed funding to take a huge step toward development of the aquifer recharge project, first conceived by Governor Kulongoski 2 years ago and then initiated by this body with HB 1069 in 2008. I ask that you help us move this critically necessary injection of funding into the Umatilla Basin so our collective water needs can be addressed and the collaboration that defines the Umatilla Basin can help lead Oregon to new heights. Chairman Cannon and members of the committee, I want you to know that we consider our tribal water rights settlement part of the basin water supply needs, just as we consider our tribal economy tied to the region's productivity. Both projects include salmon protections and stream flow considerations alongside irrigation water supply development. Our membership in the Umatilla Basin Water Coalition is reflective of the dedication of my tribal government to working collectively with our neighbors, with the governor, and with this legislative body. I thank you for your time and appreciate your consideration of the role of Oregon in implementation of aquifer recharge in the Umatilla Basin. Thank you.
Thank you. So I think we've gotten the beginning, at least, of an overview of the kind of water needs and challenges facing the basin, as well as an introduction to the proposal in the governor's budget, continuing the work that's already underway on ultimately providing for aquifer recharge using Columbia River winter water. Are there any questions for these panelists before we move on? Representative Smith?
And speaking to the record, it was great having a chance to speak with you earlier before this hearing. One thing that would be valuable is the economic multipliers that we anticipate from getting this done. And the reason I offer that is not merely to persuade members of this committee, but because in the given economic times, which many fear getting worse rather than better, and with forecasts coming this week and then later in the session, to get this done, which might be one of our highest, you know, one of the best things we can do for the region and for the state, we're going to need all the arguments we can muster. And being able to, you know, use some of that math might be valuable. So you can respond to that now, but my guess is that might be something that we put together and offer later.
Thank you, Representative Smith. Representative Jensen, do you have any comments?
Well, no, I'd just like to thank the members of the panel for coming down. I think it was a very good overview, 30 minutes to cover 30 years or more worth of history and battles that have been fought, successes that have taken places, losses that have taken places, just, you know, general spirit of goodwill and hope on the part of the local community there just can't be emphasized enough. And, Mr. Chair, I have to come back to emphasize again, and I appreciate that this is redundant, I've already said it, but salmon were extinct in the Umatilla River. 75 years worth of extinction. Buy your license, come down, stay in one of our nice motels, eat in some of our nice restaurants, and you can go out on the Umatilla River during the fishery season and have the privilege of fishing for Chinook salmon. That's a story that is not repeated in very many communities in this nation. And given the success that we've had with that, I think speaks as loudly as anything about the partnerships that are formed there that can make the continued development of this resource in the Umatilla Basin even more successful.
Thank you. Representative Gillies.
I just want to be clear. Is your grandson available as a guide?
You would do worse.
He's confident that he'd do worse. That's why he wants your grandson as a guy. That's the issue.
Well, we look forward to the hospitality that we'll find in the Umatilla Basin when we're on our fishing trip. Thank you, Representative Jensen, for your comments. Thank you for your testimony. And with that, I'm going to close the informational hearing on water issues in the Umatilla and open a public hearing on House Bill 2406. And we will start out. Yes. Sorry, Representative Smith, you want to testify? Great. And I have a panel that will include Steve Eldridge, Tammy Dene, and John DiLorenzo. But Representative Smith, thank you for being here.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I'm used to saying co-chair over in Ways and Means. Mr. Chair, it's good seeing you. Thank you very much for having me here this morning or this afternoon and allowing me to testify. For the record, I'm Representative Greg Smith, and I have the distinct pleasure of representing District 57, which includes Morrow and Umatilla County, portions of Umatilla County. part of that Umatilla River that Representative Jensen shared comments about, and also Union and Willowa County. What I want to do, if I may, is just take a moment and share with you the value of the Columbia River and the value of water in District 57 and District 58. Paramount to teaching every one of us is the notion that the Columbia River provides fish and wildlife habitat. It provides habitat for deer, provides habitat for migrating waterfowl, provides habitat for many, many species of animal. It also is a natural pathway for some of Oregon's most pristine fish, which each and every one of you know about. It also has other values, and that is the Columbia River provides flood control. And it wasn't so many years ago that having a few dams on the river provided flood control for the city of Portland and for many of our suburban communities. The Columbia River also provides for navigation. Many, many of the containers that flow through the Port of Portland start or originate at the Port of Umatilla or the Port of Morrow, or even further upriver, even going into the Snake River system. The Columbia River also provides value in recreation. Whether you're upriver where I reside or downriver with government island in the Columbia, there's a tremendous amount of recreational value. There's one other important component of the Columbia River, and that is it provides needed water for irrigation. And irrigation is the lifeblood of north central and northeastern Oregon. Many of you folks have had an opportunity to drive up and down I-84, and you've had an opportunity to see many of those irrigation pivots that dot the land of District 57 and District 58. What I'd like to share with you is that irrigation provides food, and it provides fuel for part of our biofuels industry. In the last session, this body, passed House Bill 2210, which effectively made a statement that the biofuel initiative is important to Oregonians. We wanted to look at alternative sources of fuel, and one of those we looked at was biofuel. And I'm proud and pleased to share with you that the largest biofuel facility in the state of Oregon resides right in the Port of Morrow in Morrow County in District 57. Well, there's one component of biofuel, and that is it needs raw material. And raw material needs water. And that's why I'm here today to share my support with you for House Bill 2406. In order for the state of Oregon to continue to advance its biofuel initiative, we need water. It's just a fact of life. And House Bill 2406 is a compromise bill to a bill that was introduced last session. Last session, in a bipartisan manner, we were able to pass over to the Senate a request for 500,000 acre-feet of water. Unfortunately, we weren't able to get it passed in the Senate. And so this time around, we're coming back and we're saying, how about if we just try and get 132,000 acre-feet of water? Enough to keep us operating until we can find a long-term viable solution to Oregon's strategy for water storage and usage. What House Bill 2406 says is, this isn't a permanent fix. We know it's not a permanent fix, but we have a real water shortage, and we need some temporary solutions until a final permanent solution can be achieved. What House Bill 2406 will do is will allow 132,000 acre-feet of water less, well, to put it in proper perspective, more water is lost to evaporation than would be drawn out of the Columbia River. Water that we can use to support our biofuels initiatives and water that we can use to support our local farmers. You're going to have many difficult decisions before you today and in the coming weeks. What I'd ask you to do is help me step up and support our biofuel initiative. Help us step up and tell Pacific Ethanol, that facility at the Port of Morrow that we last session said was important, help me to step up and tell them we do care about you, we do care about this industry, and we recognize the importance of water. Help us to introduce a temporary measure until a longer-term solution can be had, and help us by passing House Bill 2406. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative Smith. And am I right in thinking that your floor name was land, from the land of loaves and fishes?
That is correct.
Your testimony reminded me of that.
That is correct. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thanks for being here. Are there questions? Yeah, Representative Smith.
Thanks. It's good to see you, long-lost Brother Smith.
Yes, yes.
Appreciate your testimony.
You're the brother with hair.
We'll see. Time has impact on all people. The question I have, and it also might be a conversation for after, but short of 2406, so there are people in this room who are going to disagree on any number of things, and I've already heard from folks who fear that 2406 will break the consensus that has developed in the region that has helped bring back, you know, led to the great story we heard from the representative to my left. The short of 2406, or setting 2406 aside for half a moment, is there anything we can do to get an interstate compact between us and Washington? Because we may disagree on lots of things, but one thing we would agree is that everybody here likes Oregon better than Washington.
Right.
Okay, we could unite in our disapproval of that state, the general matter, and notice that they take a lot more water from the Columbia than we take. And that doesn't mean we necessarily want to take more, but we might want them to take less, I don't know. But any thoughts about, for rookies such as I, how we might, you know, broker ourselves a better deal, setting aside 2406?
Well, I'd share with you, Mr. Chair and Representative Brother Smith. This is a discussion that has been going on for years, and the discussion is far greater and far more complex than just Oregon and Washington, and it involves multiple states, including Montana and Idaho and our neighbor to the north, Canada. I appreciate your observation in terms of water usage. Right now, the state of Washington uses approximately 33% of its net irrigation withdrawal, while Oregon uses 8%. And so, effectively, you've got our neighbor to the north who's using almost four times the amount of water out of the Columbia that we are. While I obviously can't speak for the executive branch, what I would share with you is this representative, and I do feel comfortable saying that representative from District 58 would be more than willing to work with our colleagues across the river to try and find a more equitable use of water. What House Bill 2406 does is it says we don't want to break up any arrangements or any work that is forthcoming. We acknowledge some good, solid agreements between our tribal neighbors, between agriculture, between the environmental community, are all advancing forward. We know that. What we're saying is, though, there's going to be a period of time between now and the time actual construction can begin on projects, capital construction projects to store water, then we need a temporary solution. And what House Bill 2406 does is provides that temporary solution to help support our biofuels initiative.
Representative Smith, I don't suppose you'll mind if I ask Representative Schaffler to come forward to present his view of the matter as well.
Wonderful.
I'll be brief, Mr. Chairman.
Good to see you here.
Thank you for having me. I'm Mike Schaffler, State Representative from Happy Valley, Outer Southeast Portland, District 48. And if anyone from my district's watching this and wants to know why I'm interested in this, I can just tell you right now, the better they're doing upriver, the better we're doing downriver. It all flows right through Portland. And to my friend who shares the Senate district with me, I would never ask Washington to take less water out of that river, and I ain't ever gonna. You know, it's pretty simple for me, Mr. Chairman. We have an opportunity here that will have a great positive impact on our ability to maintain and create jobs throughout Oregon, get more revenue to educate, medicate, incarcerate, and not have any negative impacts on the environment. And that is what I believe, and that's why I fight so hard for this. And to be quite frank with you, sir, we have the votes for this bill on the House floor. I think we have it on the Senate floor, and I think any governor who didn't sign this bill would be irresponsible. And I'm being very blunt here. But for a small handful of people, this bill is being held up, and we're standing in the way of economic development, economic security, and a stronger Oregon.
And I just cannot say enough about this. My friend here to the left has given you a bunch of statistics. I just, for the life of me, when I see our neighbors taking much fuller advantage of the resources they've been blessed with, you can look right across the river going up the highway and see the benefits and the results of this kind of action. And why we're not doing it, sir, is beyond me. So I think I'm just going to leave it at that.
Thank you very much.
I'll answer any questions if necessary. If not, I'm going to leave.
Well, we're sorry you're not sticking around to hear more
questions. Mr. Chair, I'm not going very far.
Didn't expect so. Thank you both, and appreciate your continued advocacy on this issue. Steve Eldridge, Tammy Dene, I hope I have that last name right, and John DiLorenzo will carry on. We do have a list of other witnesses. It goes on to 2 pages, so we have a number of folks here. I'll ask folks to keep it brief.
Go ahead, Steve.
Go ahead.
Tammy Denny is not able to join us. She got stuck in Pendleton. My name is Steve Eldridge. I'm general manager of Umatilla Electric Cooperative in Hermiston, Oregon. And thank you, Chairman Cannon and members of the committee, for giving us a few minutes here today. And I'd like to start out by talking a little bit about Umatilla Electric. It may seem odd to you that electric cooperative utility would be involved in water. And I want to start out by just making sure everyone understands what we are. We're a nonprofit electric cooperative that was formed in the Great Depression by Franklin Delano Roosevelt in 1937, and we are literally owned by the people we serve. So our shareholders, our customers, the people who have equity in our company are one and the same, which makes it easy to follow their direction. We have access to federal funds, both directly and guaranteed, and we have access to the federal base energy system. And because of those, we also have a monopoly position in the state of Oregon. So there's an expectation of both our lenders and the state that we would use those benefits to help our communities thrive. And we have a long history of doing that. We formed the first economic development group in Hermiston in the 60s and brought Marlette trailer manufacturing to town. We pioneered water and energy conservation in the 1980s when we had the last recession. Some of you might remember. I remember it. And in fact, we were recognized by the U.S. Department of Energy for Fred Saari's work. And that the insight was that by conserving water, you also conserve energy, use less fertilizer, and from that, many, many innovations have taken place. We helped the rollout of cell phones in rural areas. We helped form a cooperative, a national cooperative to partner with DirecTV so that our members could have cable programming. We sold that investment and invested in telecommunications and helped form Lightspeed Networks, which is the only protected ring within the boundaries of Oregon. So when Umatilla County commissioners proposed that there be a moratorium on all water withdrawal, including domestic, in Umatilla County, we decided that we had to help solve this issue. And if there's any message that I'd like to leave today is that the use of water, this is not irrigation for large farms. It's not just that. But water is really an essential ingredient to the infrastructure of our modern society. It's the fabric of our particular community. Our revenues rely about 60% from either irrigated agriculture or processing plants that process these products locally. And since that's a primary dollar, then the multiplier of that farm gate value is 4 to 7 times throughout the economy. This could result, our bill could result, in $120 million annually and about 1,000 jobs. Now, we're very much in favor of what you heard earlier. This bill is being proposed because we think it may be 5 years or longer before it's on the ground. It's going to take $50 million or more investment. And given the economy and the ability to fund these things, we're very concerned that a very long time could go by before what you heard earlier about flooding the alluvial aquifers could actually be utilized. So this is meant to be a stopgap. The same economics are true both for this bill and for the future underground storage bill, if it's allowed to happen. Senator or Representative Barnhart asked the crucial question, I think, and that is, what is the capacity of these gravels? Will it really clean? Will DEQ really allow it to be put in these ancient waters? Those are questions that may take years to resolve. And in the interim, Senate Bill 1069 was the first action the state of Oregon took to solve a problem they helped create. They gave those water rights to develop the ground, and we did a good job at it. And then they curtailed those rights with no mitigation whatsoever. This allows that, but it may be so long in coming that it won't matter. And the 132,000 acre feet replaces what you saw in that earlier slide. It's the other two-thirds for that ground. And it's restoring, re-irrigating that ground that the state took out of production is where this vast economic benefit, which nobody disagrees with. And as you listen to the people today, I would ask you to look and hear and listen to the things that we have in common. Everyone you'll hear recognizes the essential nature of water. We all want more water. We all believe we'll need more water. We all agree that the Columbia River is a vital place to get that water. We all agree that it is modern society itself that is the overwhelming impact on fish and wildlife. It's not withdrawal of water from the Columbia by itself. And we all have our own plans for more water. Some you'll hear about and some you won't. What we disagree about is how to obtain more Columbia River water. You, by approving this bill, I believe, can help us maintain the agreements, maintain our economy, and move to the next era of the use of the Columbia River. Thank you very much.
Thanks. Mr. DiLorenzo.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and members of the committee. For the record, my name is John DiLorenzo. I'm a partner with the law firm of Davis Wright Tremaine. We serve as special counsel to the Umatilla Electric Cooperative, and I'm here also to testify in support of House Bill 2406. You have a large book in front of you. It's our resource book that we prepared. We're certainly not going to tick through each of these items this afternoon, but we've assembled a number of resources that we may refer to today and throughout this debate, and we thought we would put it all together for you so that you have a convenient book to reference from time to time if any of these materials become relevant. And speaking of that, I would ask that maybe you turn to tab 2, which is a chart within the resource book, and I think it shows definitely graphically that compared to Washington, Oregon uses very little water from the Columbia River. We start with a total flow of the Columbia River measured at the mouth, which is approximately 198 million acre-feet. Of the 198 million acre-foot flow, 93% ultimately reaches the Pacific Ocean. The net irrigation withdrawals taken by all states from the Columbia River are only 7% of the total flow. Of that 7%, the state of Idaho takes 52%. The state of Washington utilizes 33%. Oregon uses only 7.36%, followed by Montana at 7.22%. Representative Smith asked about an interstate compact and why an interstate compact might be helpful. We agree that an interstate compact would be very helpful, but as Representative Clem stated on the floor of the House when the House approved last session, the Oregon Oasis Bill, there is absolutely no incentive for our sister states to enter into a compact with us when they are the ones who are taking the lion's share of the water. In fact, passage of a bill which would entitle some irrigators and municipalities to some year-round withdrawal might very well be the thing that convinces those who are drawing the lion's share that a compact would be useful. But for that, there will be no compact. Why should any of those states engage in discussions with us about a compact when they draw the lion's share? House Bill 2406 would make 132,000 acre-feet of Columbia River water available to recharge or replace the critical groundwater that affects approximately 52,000 acres of land. I'd like to say that, first of all, the project you heard about moments ago that Mr. Norris described is what we also support. We, along with the coalition of interested parties in the basin, support the water recharge project as the ultimate resolution, that one that was envisioned in Senate Bill 1069 that was passed during the 2008 special session. There are problems, however, and impediments with respect to that that vision. And as Mr. Eldridge noted, DEQ has yet to weigh in as to what would be the impact of pumping those quantities of treated water into the deep basalt aquifers. They do self-clean as they are poured over the shallow alluvial aquifers, but it is yet another matter to be pumping treated water deep into the basalts. No one has yet heard what DEQ's position on that would be. The largest impediment, though, the greatest impediment, is the $50 to $100 million that would be used to build out the infrastructure. The infrastructure is already there for withdrawal. The farmers already have wells that go into those aquifers. They've been shut off by the department because of the critical levels that they're experiencing. But to get the water there will cost $50 to $100 million. I don't know where we're going to get that money or when. We believe that the build-out here is at least 7 years out, 5 to 7 years out. In the meantime, the number of acres which could ultimately be devoted to growing lush crops will continue to lie fallow. House Bill 2406 is therefore advocated as an interim solution. At Section 5, it currently contains a sunset provision to show our good faith with respect to it being an interim solution. However, I would like to make very clear that the proponents are willing to discuss with the affected interest groups a variety of alternatives, including possibly a formula for ratcheting back the year-round use as underground storage capacity comes online. In addition, we are willing to add provisions to the bill which would require mitigation, such that for every 2 acre-feet used for irrigation, 1 acre-foot would be left for critical groundwater restoration. We are also open to any other helpful suggestions made by any stakeholders in this debate. So I'd like to make it very clear that this is a work in process, and we are very open-minded with respect to how we proceed. I would like to take just a couple moments to talk about how the bill, though, addresses the most significant concerns that were voiced by the OASIS opponents during the 2007 legislative session. Although this is a pared-down version, some of those objections are sure to reemerge. The basic objection to the 500,000-acre-foot withdrawal plan was that it would irreparably harm fish. That was the major objection we heard. That was made in the face of expert testimony and studies which illustrated the absence of any impact of withdrawals envisioned by the 500,000-acre-foot withdrawal. Some groups admitted that there were no studies that were brought to the fore that contradicted our studies, but suggested that if we allowed year-round withdrawals, the cumulative impact of our withdrawals and others who then followed our model would result in what was called death by a thousand cuts, that it wasn't sufficient to analyze this in a vacuum, that once we established a precedent, others would follow, and there would be significant issues with respect to fish travel time, etc. In making those arguments, the opponents did not produce any models or studies. We made available Dr. James Anderson, who was the director of Columbia Basin Research at the School of Aquatic Fisheries and Sciences at the University of Washington. Dr. Anderson was asked to utilize the same computer models that are relied upon by NOAA Fisheries. Utilizing those models, Dr. Anderson was asked to estimate the effect of a 500,000-acre-foot withdrawal envisioned by that project on steelhead hydrosystem survival. His credentials and testimony and report is appended to your resource book at tab 4. The other studies, which he cited in his paper, are also appended in your resource book at tabs 5, 6, 7, 8, and 9. At page 6 of his testimony, which is at tab 4, he concluded by stating, quote, using the best available information, I conclude that withdrawals on the order proposed by the Oregon Oasis Project will not have a measurable impact on juvenile salmon and steelhead migration through the Columbia River. Now, we later asked him to analyze, if pressed, how many adult fish might the Oregon Oasis Project at 500,000 feet, acre feet of withdrawal, take compared to river harvest. Using estimates of survival for stream Chinook and beginning only focusing only on the spawning fish, he took 2,500 spawners in his hypothetical model. He concluded that harvest would take 450 fish, and the original Oregon Oasis Project would take 7. The withdrawals envisioned by 2406 are 1/5 to 1/4 of the requested original legislation. If you apply this relationship to Dr. Anderson's analysis, the impact of this temporary program might be 1 or 2 spawning fish per year, possibly. That compared to a potential $120 million economic advantage. House Bill 2406 is meant to be an interim solution. We address the death by a thousand cuts argument by making it an interim solution. It would be very difficult for others to depend upon it as a precedent when it would automatically ratchet back as underground storage would come on board. And we feel that it is the interim nature of this program that avoids the death by a thousand cuts argument, which had some rationality associated with it, we admit.
So, John, we have your written testimony here. I'm going to ask you to summarize the last several pages of it.
Okay. I'd be happy to do that, Mr. Chairman. We also believe there will be no federal impediments. There are no NEPA studies required because there is no federal action. We utilize all existing pumping facilities. There is no need for Army Corps permits or any other permits. We do not believe that Oregon would be exposed under the ESA for any take, since even under the ESA, potential plaintiffs must show the likelihood of a take, and we are convinced that this program would have no measurable impact on fish. We believe that this program will not in any way interfere with the tribe's Phase 3 program. The tribes are currently involved in settlement discussions with the federal government. They are attempting to assert a federal water right. We believe that this program is a temporary solution is completely independent of that effort. In fact, we intend to be at the table when the federal government works with the tribes and others to discuss whether they have or do not have a water right under their treaty. We are very supportive of what the tribes are doing economically. We are all supportive of them having water. We would just like some water, too. In conclusion, we believe that the risks to salmon recovery posed by House Bill 2406 are extremely low, if not unmeasurable. They are more than offset by the sure benefits that are occasioned by 2406. The vast economic benefits, including the new jobs, growth potential for new communities, and recognition of Northwestern Oregon as deserving of economic growth, are certainly worth the minimal risk. Mr. Chairman, we believe that our clients through last session and now have certainly met our burden of persuasion. We believe that burden should now shift to rebut our points. We believe the state has a golden opportunity at hand, and we should enact this plan until dependable underground storage is available. I want to thank you, Mr. Chair, for your courtesies and the attention of the committee, and we are available to answer any questions.
Great questions for either Ms. Representative Smith.
And I won't pose this as a question. I'll pose it speaking to the record and for the knowledge of the room and of the panel. It was also nice getting a chance to speak with you and learn even more about this issue. And I just want to say that I think we're going to need, for there to be any hope that this falls any better fate than it fell last time. There will need to be a clear, but my hunch is there will need to be a relatively clear path to an interstate compact. And I happen to know that at least a vote or two that was with you last time is contingent upon that. And if there isn't a clear path, you can't count on it. And I'll speak just as frankly as my friend Representative Schaffler spoke. So the I just want to say that as we're doing it, like hear your argument that it would be necessary to do this to have any hope at interstate compact, but would also want some confidence, or at least the argument might be helped if we had some confidence that we were moving towards sufficiency in that same enterprise.
Thanks. Other comments or questions, Representative Gilliam?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just real quickly, Mr. Eldridge, I appreciate you coming, and I wanted to ask you, also I noted in your testimony, you get 9 inches of water over there, of rainfall, and we get 39. It's difficult for me to be grateful for that at this time of year, but I don't make light of this, and I just want to ask you, Representative Smith said this is a compromise bill. Do you agree with that, or could you elaborate?
Well, I think that... I think there's a couple things, if I could, that's kind of a long answer. One is, in Oregon, 90% of the water that's taken from the Columbia for irrigation occurs in our little basin. So the risk of us having more water being translated in other parts, I believe, is very small because the economics don't support it. So I still stand by what was called for by the Oregon Oasis as being really the solution. It restores all the critical groundwater, and it gives the opportunity to develop the last of the possible other farmland that could be brought into production. That we didn't feel was politically doable. So this is the compromise, and it is a companion to what the governor himself has proposed. So, yes, I would agree with that statement.
Thank you.
I have a question. Could you be precise about who would benefit if we pass this bill? Who gets this water under the bill?
Individually, we have 400 members in these critical groundwater areas. Not all farms. Most of them are independently owned farms of varying sizes, and we could give you an exact list. I can't today.
Yeah, obviously, I'm not interested in names per se, but some, you know, as precise as you can be without getting to names, these are farms in a particular area. How well does it map to the critical groundwater areas that we saw?
The parts that that aren't in this that I think would be difficult with the 1069 focuses primarily on two of the four critical groundwater areas. What our proposal is would provide water beyond that that do not have the alluvial storage that the county line area. So Elba Butte, I think, is not in what's being proposed under what you heard from the people before us. But our proposal is enough to restore all 62,000 acres that are identified that were either restricted or taken out of production in those four critical groundwater areas.
So let me clarify. Everybody who is operating under restrictions, meaning they're not able to utilize the water rights that they have,
correct,
would benefit from your proposal.
Yes. Now, I think it would be like a sponge filling up in this regard. And nobody's understanding of what's happening under the ground is exact. But one of our board members is in a critical groundwater area about halfway between Hermiston and Pendleton. Now, everybody's restricted in a certain one of these areas. So if one user goes off, there's potentially another user could go up. So, for example, if you had neighboring farms and one, because of existing infrastructure, was able to get replacement water from the Columbia, so he pumped less out of his well, that may allow his neighbor who doesn't have access to the infrastructure could pump a little more because as a total, you still meet the requirements as set by the state. So as that develops and more infrastructure then is afforded, then I think it'll be a combination of both groundwater and the river, because what we're proposing from the river to totally replace it would have to be closer to 200,000 acre feet. Did not have any groundwater pumping. Did that answer your question?
Well, yeah, I think it may be a point worth following up on in continued conversation.
Okay.
Because if I understand you correctly, it's not as if all affected folks would hold permits now for Columbia River withdrawals, but the impact of Columbia withdrawals on some growers in the basin would free up, you're presuming would free up some groundwater for others who may be farther from the Columbia and not permit holders.
In my judgment, it would take some time to get throughout it.
Representative Boone.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair. When I met with some of the, it's too bad Tammy's not here today, because I met with a couple of her growers from the area in discussion about what it means to, for example, to Representative Smith, Representative Bailey in Portland, the wheat people have a program called Bushels for Betsy. And the farmers grow this wheat and they give it to, I think, I remember, I don't have a sheet, but the thing I remember was 33,000 pounds of pancake mix to Krusty's that went to Portland's homeless shelters and services to feed the people who need more food. That being said, my interest was piqued in that area because I asked, okay, ethanol growth or corn for ethanol is one thing. What about corn or wheat or other food products for food? And in the week before we started hearing about this bill, we had the peanut scare. And a lot of the food safety issues that have come forward, and I'm a great person for growing my own whatever, but I haven't had a garden in 4 years. So I depend on markets, local markets, and I think that people are really getting into this local food thing, not just because it's cool or whatever, but because it's good for you, and it's safer in a lot of cases. At least we know where it's coming from. And that's kind of my interest in this, too. If we can allow these farmers to grow more food for us during this time in lands that now is just laying fallow, nothing happening. And I get this because I have a little wheat farm in North Dakota, too. And we gave over half of it to ducks when the wetlands came up instead of filling our wetlands. Long other story. But I'm just saying I think that there's an issue here that's not being brought up, and that is food safety and also food production. We're one of the biggest wheat producers in the country. And I think it's. I think this is something we can do. Also, if you look at the economic drivers for that, it's not just the farmers and the food processors. It's all the other areas of economic growth in these areas that will benefit, and it will provide jobs, and it will keep other people who might go under and then become dependent on our state services from having to do that. These are really resilient people.
Thanks for your comments, and I can assure you that it's absolutely true what you say about the interest of my constituents I know in local foods and in safe foods, and I know they'll take an interest in these proceedings if only for that reason. Let's go ahead and move. Representative Jensen, you want to?
Mr. Chair,
yep.
I'm not sure exactly what your plan or agenda is for this particular meeting, how long intend to plan to go with it today. I'm sure there are other people on the list that are signed up.
There are. We have about, just to be answer your question, Representative Jensen, we have about 9 folks signed up. We have about 45 minutes. I don't plan to stay past 5, so we'll have to move along here.
Given that, Mr. Chair, I'd like to just make a brief sort of comment here, which I will in this committee at other times expand on considerably. One of the things, and I think you ask a very pertinent and important point about who gets the benefit of this, and I hear us asking this question about a whole bunch of things as we go through the process here, you know, in this body. I heard this debated about who gets the benefit of this when we talked about a light rail at one time, and I hear this talked about in relationship to, excuse me, I'm going to introduce the word I want into the record on this, who gets the benefit of the infrastructure and the infrastructure development. And I would like to submit to this committee that this is what I think we're talking about when we talk about water in the state of Oregon, is a very fundamental point of our infrastructure. As the representative pointed out, take the water away, And what have you got? It is absolutely critical to our way of life. Whether as a person, I'm invested heavily in the environmental movement, or whether as a person I'm invested heavily in the agricultural movement, without water, it's a void, sort of thing. Basically, certainly there would be, if this particular project were developed, there would be people in Umatilla, Morrow, and perhaps other places that might financially benefit. But there'd also be, jobs developed, taxes paid, contributions made, to the economy, food produced, the serious part of it is we are living in a time when food production is falling drastically behind. It absolutely blows my mind that people in Oregon, suffering from the lack of food, malnutrition, that children are suffering, from this. And we live in a very sheltered society, sort of thing. So we can't ignore this issue of food production, sort of thing. So I would like to get away from who's going to get the benefit of this, because it should be society, Oregon, that's going to get the benefit of this. Some individuals located at some particular point are going to perhaps reap some extra benefits out of it, but if it isn't good for the state, then it's not good. It's not whether it's good for Bob Jensen or not. It's whether it's good, for the state. And I would submit that as far as our water is concerned, like we have done with much of the rest of our infrastructure, Mr. Chairman, is we have failed in the last 100 years to keep our infrastructure developed. We built freeways through here that we thought, in 1950s, 1970s, that we thought were the panacea, that this was the answer to transportation for time and all eternity. In just recent years, we have found that, you couldn't move a D8 cat across the freeway, from La Grande to Pendleton, because there's some of the bridges there wouldn't take the load. So you had to make a, wide sweep around where you didn't have any bridges in order to get that cat to a needed project. As a state, I would submit, we have to seriously look at our infrastructure and putting our resources into developing that infrastructure for the betterment of the future of the state of Oregon. And I would submit that water is a basic infrastructure, basic part of the infrastructure.
Thank you for your perspective and wisdom, as usual, Representative Smith, and take your point about the need to consider this value for the state, not just the people who are most directly impacted by whatever we might do here. I expect that as a committee we could discuss this at much greater length, and perhaps we'll have the opportunity to do that. Representative Benz, do you want to?
Very short.
Very short, because this is a public hearing. I have to remind my committee, we invited the public to come and talk to us.
Just a question. I think, do I understand correctly that you don't need any more pumps or pivots? All that stuff is in place, and this is merely water that would be used for those existing irrigation systems that are already there?
Mr. Chair and Representative Benz, that is correct. The bill does not require any expenditure by the state of Oregon other than whatever administrative costs would be would result in staff looking over permits. It makes the water available to whomever has a water right that has been curtailed and who illustrates the ability to deliver the water to the site. We would utilize existing pumping systems. There would really be no infrastructure investment required of the state of Oregon for this interim solution.
Thank you. We will we'll continue this discussion with a few other folks. So thank you very much for
thank
your
you, Mr.
testimony.
Chair. Thank you, members.
And a few people who have traveled a good distance to be here. Let's start with Rick George from the tribes, Dennis Doherty, who we heard from during the info session. And he will be joined, they will be joined by Bill Kluding, who hasn't come quite as far, but you're welcome up here as well.
Thank you, Chairman Cannon, members of the committee, Representative Jensen. For the record, my name is Rick George. I'm a staff member with the Confederated Tribes of the Umatilla Indian Reservation, and it's an honor to be here today. My comments will be short. The Confederated Tribes of the Umatilla Indian Reservation cannot support House Bill 2406, and the reasons for that are very clear and very succinct. Number one, it wasn't brought before the Umatilla Coalition for review. It wasn't brought to the tribal government for review. From our perspective, there's a dearth of support for the bill in the basin. And really, when the tribes look at the practicality of getting the water to the basin, they think the basin itself has the right answer. And that's the first topic of discussion in today's hearing, That method for delivery of the needed water comes from the project that is supported by the governor's office, is supported by the tribe, is supported by the basin itself, and I think you'll see the speed with which water is delivered to dry ground really stem from the aquifer recharge project. That's where the momentum is. That's where the funding is directed toward. That's really where the state, the tribes, the basin irrigators, the basin leadership has coalesced around. And it's that process that has very consciously, strategically addressed the difficult issues, the difficult hurdles for getting new Columbia River water delivered to anywhere, whether it's in Oregon or Washington. The Aquifer Recharge Project is the project that has addressed the Endangered Species Act, has addressed intertribal Columbia River Treaty Tribe policy on water and fish, accommodates and is actually being led, of course, by the governor's office and the Water Resources Department, and thus is consistent with state policy. So just from a very practical standpoint, the tribes believe that the project that is going to deliver water quickly, efficiently, and effectively to irrigators that need it, and that the tribe itself supports, is the governor's project, the Aquifer Recharge Project, and as a result, the tribe decided that they could not support House Bill 2406 and wanted to communicate that to the committee today. Thank you.
Thanks, Rick. Commissioner.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Dennis Doherty, Umatilla County Commissioner. The Board of Commissioners appreciates the efforts of anyone who is genuinely committed to address Umatilla Basin water supply needs. We have a 150-year history of this. And in the modern era, we are depending upon the collaborative approach to get us further than we did in the first 130 years. We're especially appreciative of the efforts that some are making to keep in front of you and others the fairness issue. We hear all the time in our basin, you know, why does Washington get this and we only get that? I suspect that somewhere in the workings of people higher than we are, there is an opportunity to collaborate between the states. And I do hope that the state of Oregon, in its collaborations with the state of Washington, is addressing this issue and keeping the interests of jurisdictions within the state of Oregon in mind. You know, on any subject matter, there's likely to be an end game and a point of beginning. And on this one, you know, I think we're really just at the point of beginning. Actually, Senate Bill 1069 was the point of beginning. The bigger the elephant, of course, the more bites you have to take to eat the darn thing. The Board of Commissioners in Umatilla County feels that the potential for a successful outcome in 2009 is greater if we focus on the Umatilla Recharge Project. And if we continue with that collaborative and forward-thinking project, we will have constructed something that we can build on and incrementally eat this elephant over a period of time. We like the fact that it's collaborative, that it's giving attention to the allocation of costs and benefits between public and private partners, that it's a build-out of existing infrastructure, which is inevitably going to have to be done if we're going to spread water around those critical groundwater areas. And we like the fact that, at least at this time in our lives, it utilizes winter water rather than summer water. Our experience has been that when we go after summer water, we run into a wall that, at least in our basin, we're not big enough to breach. Our collaborations are very important to us. The Board of Commissioners is collaborating with the tribes. The tribes have opposed this. That's important to us to honor our commitment to the tribes. Umatilla Electric is a member of our coalition. We don't want to poke Umatilla Electric in the eye. I think that why we support the Aquifer Recharge Project can be summarized as follows. The collaboration has already been done, not just at our local level, but also between local and state level. The groundwork in the form of the feasibility study is near completion, and all indications are that the public and private benefits that are expected are going to be validated by the study. We know how the water will get from the Columbia River to its intended use as this project is built out. We know the benefits that it will produce, and we know how widely they will be spread geographically and among the intended users. And we know that the Aquifer Recharge Project fits into a good, carefully thought through long-term strategy, which has been crafted to satisfy the needs of many and to avoid divisiveness, controversy, and litigation. For these reasons, the Umatilla Basin Water Coalition cannot support 2406 at this time, and the Board of Commissioners endorses the Aquifer Recharge Project and cannot support House Bill 2406 at this time. Thank you.
Thank you again, Commissioner Daugherty. Are there questions by either of these guests? If not, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Let's have Janet Newman. Could you join us at this point, as well as our agency folks, Tom Paul and Kurt Melcher? I invited Janet to come today knowing that she could help provide some, I hesitate to use the word neutral because who's really neutral, but an independent perspective on some of the water issues in the Columbia Basin. And Janet, I'll let you introduce yourself, but came highly recommended and a professor of law at Lewis and Clark and someone with real deep experience in water issues on the Columbia. So, Janet, will you go ahead?
Yes, thank you. Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I will try to briefly hit the highlights of the written testimony that I've submitted. I am a law professor at Lewis and Clark Law School, where I teach water law, among other subjects. I'm on a year-long sabbatical working with the Tonkin Thorpe firm in Portland on an up-council basis, but I'm not here representing any client, and I'm not here representing the law school. I am representing my perspectives and opinions, which are based on nearly two decades of studying and teaching water law. I've been steeped in our state's water law because I'm about to publish a book, a reference book, a treatise on Oregon water law, but I'm familiar with other states as well. I previously was the director of the Department of State Lands, then the Division of State Lands, and the first president of the Oregon Water Trust for many years, which is a group that buys water rights and converts them to in-stream flows. And I was also a member of the Western Water Policy Review Advisory Commission appointed by President Clinton that studied federalism issues in Western water law. The purpose of my testimony, as I said, it's not representing any particular party. It's
I'm sorry, before you go on, I have a note that you should state your name for the record. I think you might have, but you may not have. So.
I thought I did. Okay, yes, I'm Janet Newman. Thank you. And the purpose of my testimony is to provide the committee with some context for your discussion of House Bill 2406. I just want to summarize a couple of facts about the Columbia River itself, and then I want to talk briefly about the law of the river, which is something that water lawyers use to refer to the entire management scheme that governs use of water in any particular river. You've heard already that the average flow at the mouth of the Columbia is about 198 million acre-feet annually, and at the Dalles it's about 134 million acre-feet annually. What you have to appreciate, and I know you do, is that the actual flows at any given time range from a fraction of those averages to multiples of those averages, depending on both the year and the season. 25% of the Columbia flow originates in Canada, and we can't forget that. On the U.S. side, there are more than 30 federal dams in the Columbia Basin, dozens of non-federal dams, five major dams on the Canadian side as well. On our side, the dams are 22 Corps of Engineers dams, and those are authorized by federal law for flood control and navigation. Nine are Bureau of Reclamation irrigation dams of the major federal dams. The BPA does not operate dams, but instead it sells power from the federal dams. And in addition to these projects' primary original purposes, each one of which has an authorization act from Congress that specifies its primary original purposes, the dams also serve purposes that have been added on: hydroelectric production, municipal and industrial water supply, recreation, fish and wildlife. Representative Smith, Greg Smith, testified to that a little bit. That's sort of the quick picture of the river itself and its and its manipulation. Now I want to talk briefly about the law of the river. The baseline of Columbia River water management is provided by federal law. And it's not just the laws governing each of these specific projects, but it's a large system that governs the operation of the Columbia River dams and power system, including a treaty with Canada. So there's the Columbia River Treaty with Canada, Pacific Northwest Coordination Agreement, which sets out how all these different agencies are going to operate the facilities on the Columbia River. And then each federal project, as I mentioned, has its own very specific authorization act. All of this then also takes place within the context of the Reclamation Act of 1902 and its many amendments, flood control laws, National Environmental Policy Act, Endangered Species Act, and other federal fish and wildlife laws, the Clean Water Act, and the Northwest Power and Conservation Act, which is embodied both in state law and in federal law, because that is one interstate compact that we have regarding the Columbia River. It doesn't divide up the water, but it lays out the procedure for dealing with the Columbia River power system and the mitigation of its impacts. So resting on this foundation of federal law, each state along the river has a certain amount of jurisdiction and authority. The states have delegated responsibility for water quality laws within the framework of the Federal Clean Water Act. The states have primary responsibility for water quantity or issuing water rights. But the reach of the state's authorities depends on which federal agency or law the state is bumping up against. And, you know, there's massive federal power for navigation and flood control that sort of trumps everything. The Bureau of Reclamation power is somewhat more constrained, and actually the Bureau complies with state law in achieving or obtaining water rights. And then the federal environmental laws are very powerful. They give the states some specific roles in the water quality area. But other than that, they tend to constrain state action. And other than you've heard a lot of talk today about interstate compacts. There have been attempts to negotiate an interstate compact on the Columbia dealing with water allocation. It has never reached the stage of agreement where it could actually be enacted into law. There is no interstate compact other than the Northwest Power Planning Compact. It's a very tough job. I mean, it's not just Washington and Oregon. It is also Idaho, Montana, Nevada, and Wyoming that have a piece of the Columbia Basin, Snake and Columbia River. The treaty with Canada governs the dam operations and reservoir operations more than water allocation, and without a compact, I mean, I appreciate the comments that have been made today about how wonderful it would be to have an interstate compact. They are tremendously difficult to negotiate, and then once they're negotiated, the states tend to appear in the Supreme Court suing each other over the interpretation and compliance with the compacts. But without a compact, there's only a couple of ways to get any certainty on how much of the flow of an interstate river each state has control over. One is by suing each other in the United States Supreme Court, and then the court uses a doctrine called equitable apportionment, which is they try to do what's fair, and there's, you know, absolutely no certainty going into a process like that as to how it's going to come out. Very, very long and expensive. And congressional apportionment, which has only been done twice anywhere, on the Colorado River and on the Pyramid Lake in Nevada. So, you know, the limping along that happens without a compact is pretty much standard operating procedure. So the last thing I want to talk about very quickly is the different approaches to Columbia management by particularly Washington and Oregon. During the early 1990s, there were moratoria on withdrawals from the Columbia put in place sort of informally by Washington, Oregon, and Idaho. I won't go through the details of how they were similar or different, but the reason for them in the first place was because the federal agencies were identifying flow problems on the Columbia during certain periods of the year as part of the reason for listing the fish species. So, the issue of whether there's a lot of water in the Columbia for the taking is not as simple as it might sound on the surface. Okay, what happened? Well, new withdrawals decreased, but they didn't stop entirely. And it is true that, you know, Idaho and Washington have maybe proceeded to grant more withdrawals than Oregon. But what I want to tell you about, just to wrap up, is what Washington has done. Washington replaced its moratorium with a very comprehensive program for Columbia River management and for issuing water rights out of the Columbia. And I know there's been some sort of joking comments about, you know, how they're taking all the water and we want some too. My advice would be that we emulate what Washington has done on the Columbia more than scorn it, because what they've done is, over a very long period of time, I mean, starting after the moratoria, their discussions began about how to free up more Columbia River water, both for in-stream flows to take care of some of the fish issues and for consumptive use. And in 2006, as a result of a lot of this work, Washington legislature adopted a bill that creates a Columbia River Basin Water Management Program. It's got some key components. It required the Department of Ecology to prepare long-term water supply and demand forecasts, update them every 5 years, directed an inventory of water supply development opportunities that includes all range of possibilities, including, you know, new storage, but also conservation and efficiency improvements, and it's focused very much on both flows and consumptive uses. Specifies how any new water that's developed, so if if new water is freed up by any kind of a project, then the law specifies how that will be allocated between in-stream and out-of-stream users and among the out-of-stream users. And it authorized the state to enter voluntary agreements with irrigation districts in order to make deals with mitigation in exchange for new water rights. And it the law specified no impact in July and August on Columbia River flows. And then it created a water supply development account that, and here's maybe the real thing to be envious of, that was funded with annual appropriations. The first year it was $16 million and also authorized up to $200 million in general obligation bonds. And because of this, I mean, you know, we aren't going to be able to find that money necessarily, but the components of what they have done is very significant. It's not just to say issue more water rights from the river. It's a comprehensive approach to look at all different kinds of possibilities. There are 18 different kinds of projects that they look at that include everything from, you know, on-farm efficiencies, aquifer storage, even, you know, fallowing, leasing, et cetera. And they are, this past year, in 2008, they funded 18 projects for a total of $46.4 million. And they're estimating that when those projects are built out, and these are actual construction projects that they funded, they're estimating 7,435 acre-feet of in-stream flow and 1,449 acre-feet for consumptive uses. And then they go on into feasibility studies from that. Their very first voluntary regional agreement with mitigation and new water rights was put together last year with the Columbia Snake River Irrigators Association. They're incorporating climate change work. They're developing a drought insurance program. So they have a very holistic, comprehensive approach in contrast to the sort of single purpose focus of 2406, which is ordering the department to issue more water rights, 131,000 acre-feet of those for irrigation, 1,000 for municipal. I think it's a little dangerous for the legislature to get in the business of codifying, you know, there will be no detrimental effect on fish, and then directing the agency to set aside whatever other priorities it might be mandated by law to do and instead to issue these water rights. I absolutely agree with what some of you have said about infrastructure. Water is an important part of our infrastructure. It's not something that we've paid enough attention to, but I don't know that the bill in its current form gets at those issues because it doesn't talk about mitigation. It doesn't talk about measurement infrastructure, conservation infrastructure. And granted, the Umatilla Basin and the northeastern part of the state has some incredibly good agricultural conservation. It's not necessarily universal, however. Washington's approach is to link the improvements with the new water withdrawals. And I think that we, again, I guess I would say that we should be emulating their approach rather than scorning it and taking a more comprehensive look at how to develop more water, both for in-stream flows and for out-of-stream uses. And I'll stop there.
Janet, thank you very much. And we'll come back to questions after we've heard, I hope, quite briefly from the agency, since I think we know, we have a letter here from our governor's office, I think we know where the executive branch stands on this, but let's hear what you have to say. Go ahead.
Okay. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Tom Paul, Deputy Director, Oregon Water Resources Department. Thank you for the opportunity to present testimony on House Bill 2406, a bill directing the Water Resources Department to issue a water right from the Columbia River amounting to about 132,000 acre-feet annually. There's no question, and you've heard over and over today, there are water issues in the Umatilla Basin, and we agree with that. The critical groundwater areas were put into place because more water was being removed from the groundwater aquifers than was being replenished. And we've seen declines by as much as 500 feet in some wells. So there are water issues. There is a need for water in the area. We have been working hard with the local representatives that you've heard today from the county and with irrigators on the Umatilla Recharge and Recovery Project. We think that that is a good way to get water to the individuals within the critical groundwater area or areas to restore those aquifers and make it available once again for irrigation. That water, as you heard earlier, is coming from the Columbia, so the Columbia River is the source to supply that need. The difference is that the water would be diverted during the winter time when the target flows to protect endangered fish are met. So it would be diverting probably from many of the same pumps that you heard the previous speakers talk about, existing facilities that are there, and you might recall, as Barry Norris talked about and showed pictures of the plumbing in the area, both pipelines and open canals. So the LIC is not a new system. It is to utilize the existing infrastructure as much as possible. The Oregon Water Resources Department does oppose this bill. We're concerned because of the direction that's being requested that would direct us to approve water right permits to divert Columbia River water during the summertime when those target flows are not currently satisfied. We're also concerned because anybody needing a water right today has to apply with the department and go through quite a public process, and giving the public an opportunity to present information either for or against, and this would appear to remove that public process from the decision-making of our department and the commission. With that, I will go ahead and end. It was very brief. We have provided written testimony on this, and you should have copies of that.
Thanks.
Thank you, Chair Cannon, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Kurt Melcher, Deputy Director for the Department of Fish and Wildlife, and I, too, will be very brief. We've provided some short written comments to you as well. The House Bill 2406, which directs the Water Resources Department to issue permits for up to 132,000 acre-feet of water from the Upper Columbia River, causes us concern with in relation to the endangered species ESA-listed fish that are present in the Columbia River during the spring migration time. These are juvenile salmon and steelhead migrating downriver during the spring. The federal biological opinion has established a number of criteria to recover these species, one of which are flow targets for the Columbia. These flow targets are in many cases not met. Idaho, Washington, and Montana all contribute water releases to the main stem Columbia in an effort to meet these target flows, and removing 132,000 acre-feet of water from the Columbia during that time would only take us further from the target flows as opposed to moving us towards those target flows. We, too, like Water Resources Department, are very supportive of the efforts underway in the Umatilla Basin and other basins with regard to winter water and looking at new opportunities to store winter water for availability during the needed growing season. With that, Mr. Chairman, I will conclude and appreciate the opportunity to be here today.
Thanks. Questions for this set of panelists, Representative Smith?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Janet Newman, at least my cohort to my left and I really were impressed with your testimony, really appreciate it, not to the detriment of your reputations, I assure you. I'll direct my question to you. Does the aquifer recharge project constitute the kind of comprehensive approach that, I don't want to use the word mirror, but that would be as good as or better than Washington's, or is it better viewed as a piece of a comprehensive approach that we have yet to adopt or even embark upon?
Chair Cannon, Representative Smith, I would say that it represents the latter. I mean, in fact, in Washington, in their comprehensive Columbia Basin program, aquifer storage and recharge is one of the many types of projects that they are doing feasibility studies for. But so it alone is not comprehensive. It's an excellent approach to new water storage and to replenishing groundwater for sure. You get storage with clean water and no evaporation, and you know it's easier to get it back out. But it's alone is not a comprehensive solution.
I also want to say, for the record, I wanted to acknowledge the person who brought me this cord. Speaking of the Umatilla Basin, is former Umatilla County District Attorney and Umatilla County Cattlemen's Company board member, and my dad, Joe Smith, just wanted, who's now sitting in the back and trying to stay awake. What would be, Ms. Newman, my last question, steps we should take if what we wanted to do was adopt a comprehensive approach, and how does that relate to the decision here on Oasis or Sun Oasis, or whatever we're calling it now, and it's related, I know, to the death by a thousand cuts critique of the last time. But how do you see our way forward at this point?
That's a good question, Mr. Chair and Representative Smith. I think that how do I see the way forward? Unfortunately, I think that the best approach would be to, you know, actually fund and put in place a program that looks at all the needs in this part of the Columbia Basin as Washington has. And I don't think that that's something we can do right now. In terms of 2406, I think if it were to be passed at all, it ought to be changed so that there's a lot more to it, so that it's tied into mitigation and conservation, it's tied into the flow targets, it looks at limiting withdrawals during the periods when the river has problems. All of the reasons that the moratoria were put in place in the first place are mostly still there. You know, nothing about the fish or the river have changed such that it can support this kind of a withdrawal unless there's mitigation for it. And I did hear Mr. DiLorenzo say that they were willing to discuss mitigation, but it has to be a comprehensive view, and nobody wants to hear that because it's not very immediate.
Representative Jensen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Ms. Newman, I would like to thank you for your testimony. I was very pleased with and impressed with what you had to say. I hope you won't be too surprised or offended if I contact you somewhere in the future here and ask for some advice.
No.
That's an excellent idea. Representative Gilliam.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I wanted to ask you quickly, Ms. Newman. You made references to the cost on the other side of the river. What are those costs? Again, if you just highlight that. And I'm trying to understand apples and oranges here, because we're talking about an interim solution that I think we're agreed is zero. Am I right or wrong about that?
In terms of cost. Mr. Chair, Representative Gilliam, I'm sure that the Water Resources Department would not see this as a cost-free solution, because it does sort of set them to a task that they already have difficulty keeping up with in terms of issuing new water rights. The commitments on the Washington side, as I said, there's up to $200 million in general obligation bonds that are allowed to be issued for this project, and then there are annual appropriations. The first annual appropriation was about $16 million. There's, if I am reading and understanding the staff people correctly, there are about 20 staff people in this Columbia Basin program. They have, in 2008, they funded 18 projects for a total of $46.4 million. Some of those are feasibility studies going forward, but lots of them are actual construction projects as well. And the list of projects that they are looking at, that they have looked at over the last couple of years, this all just started in 2006, but the list of projects includes everything from large storage, you know, they're doing some feasibility studies on some large storage projects, some small storage projects. Aquifer storage and recovery is an important piece of their approach. Modifications to existing storage, lining and piping, on-farm efficiencies, irrigation water management, system control through automation, general water conservation, surface-to-groundwater conversion, tailwater reuse, reclaimed water, crop changes, crop water duty reductions. They are sort of putting out a request for proposals, if you will, with a complete menu of how to develop new water supplies in the basin without affecting July and August flows in the river, and recognizing that when new water is developed through any of these projects, a specified amount by statute goes to in-stream flows and a specified amount goes to consumptive use.
Follow up quickly.
But I'm a little confused because on the Washington side, if we were to emulate that program, which this bill doesn't do, and you gave us some good advice that perhaps we should be doing something different than this bill, but if we're just doing this bill, we're not emulating the Washington, so the cost has got to be vastly different. Is that not right?
Mr. Chair, Representative Gilliam, yes, the cost in terms of dollars would fall, I believe, on the agencies who would need to respond to this, and it would, and then there would be opportunity costs of everything else they weren't doing, and the costs would be, I think, to the river, to the fish, to, you know, other uses of water, and to a comprehensive approach in the future. But the dollar costs, I think, are agency costs at this point.
You afford me one final follow-up.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This is actually for Mr. Paul. I know you, and I appreciate your being looking out for our fish. I always worry more about the politics of fish than actually your job of looking out for fish, but that's... Is there a study that says that the fish will be affected by this size of project? Not that you're not supposed to be cautious, don't get me wrong, but is there a study that we can point to? I didn't see it in your testimony.
Okay. Thank you, Chair Cannon, Representative Gillum. I'm actually going to defer to my partner on the left, who is with Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife, because on water right application processing, we work very closely with Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife on the fish issues. They are our experts in that area.
Well, he comes from a fine district, so that's good.
Thank you. Chair Cannon, Representative Gilliam. Representative is my representative, so that's why he made that last comment. the issue is one of... NOAA Fisheries has established target flows in their biological opinion. And so for us in commenting on this bill, it takes us further from their target flows. Now they have, a large amount of science that went into determining what those target flows were. I'm not prepared here to tell you that it's, I think, 7 fish, as I heard Mr. DiLorenzo refer to, or 700 or 7,000. I know that it takes us further from meeting those target flows, and so that's the basis of our comments here.
Okay. Thank you. I think we may hear a little more about fish from our next panelists. Thank you all, I expect you'll be hearing more from members of this committee. So thank you.
Thanks.
So let's bring John DeVoe, Tom Wolf, Tom Smoot, and Dave Moskowitz. And, you know, I apologize that we've run squash up against the end of our hearing time and have little time for these final panelists. I thought it was important to get the full airing of folks who came before you, but I recognize that's put you in the awkward position of having to speed through what you might have prepared. But I hope that you'll submit your written comments. We'll look at those, and you'll keep your oral comments quite brief, so we can move on to our 5 o'clock business.
You want to go ahead?
No. Chair Cannon, members of the committee, my name is John DeVoe, and I'm the Executive Director of Water Watch of Oregon. Thank you for the opportunity to testify. As Yogi Berra said, I feel like it's deja vu all over again, because we've been through a lot of these issues in the 2007 session. I'll just address a few of the points that have been made today. First, I'd like to note that Water Watch was very involved in the Senate Bill 1069 negotiation, and we are supportive of solutions for the Umatilla Basin if they can be achieved without harming the river and its fish. And to date, we are aware of nothing that is involved in the aquifer storage proposal that would compromise existing state laws or create problems for fish. So we're on board with that currently. I would like to address a little bit the biofuels comments that were made earlier. I have a letter from Pacific Ethanol to John DiLorenzo from May 2nd of 2008, in which Pacific Ethanol asks the proponents of the Oasis project to stop representing the Pacific Ethanol needs additional irrigated corn acreage for their feedstocks. And I'll quote you from the letter. We are concerned that a reference to Oregon's biofuel initiative and Pacific Ethanol in your, quote, policy outline Oregon Oasis Project contains inaccuracies that leave the impression that our company or the ethanol industry as a whole in the Pacific Northwest is reliant upon more irrigated acres of corn. Nationally, 87% of corn acreage is non-irrigated. They then reference a section of the policy outline which states, quote, although Pacific Ethanol is locating a plant in Boardman, Oregon, so far no farmers have signed contracts to provide corn from their 07, 08, or 09 projected harvests. This is because there is no available irrigated land from which to supply these biomass crops, end quote. The letter goes on, that statement is not true. While we would welcome contracts with local farmers, the primary barrier to sourcing local corn for our Boardman, Oregon facility is the high moisture content of Pacific Northwest corn and the lack of drying capacity in the region. So I just wanted to clarify that even if we could instantly produce a lot of irrigated corn in the Boardman area, Pacific Ethanol is not currently set up to receive it. 2406 as drafted is inconsistent with state law, and it's inconsistent with existing state policy. I'd like to be very clear that what the bill currently proposes is not an interim solution. The water rights that would be granted under this law are permanent. Furthermore, there is no mitigation proposed in this bill. This goes directly in the face of Oregon's current bucket-for-bucket mitigation plan for withdrawals of water from the Columbia above Bonneville Dam. That's a serious defect in the bill. I'd also like to point out that what the bill is designed to do is to provide Columbia River surface water to folks who are currently regulated off groundwater. There really isn't an effort to recharge the aquifer through this bill. This is simply a replacement water source for to correct the mistakes of the past in giving out too many water rights in the Umatilla Basin. There was a question about science and fish and the effects of further withdrawals of Columbia River water on fish. And I guess I would point the panel to the 2004 report of the National Research Council Committee on Water Resources Management, In-Stream Flows, and Salmon Survival in the Columbia River. The report is called Managing the Columbia River, In-Stream River Flows, Water Withdrawals, and Salmon Survival. It's 2004. It's the National Research Council. This report basically concludes that additional withdrawals from the Columbia, particularly during the dry and warm summer months, would increase the risks to survivability to listed salmon stocks and would reduce the management flexibility of fisheries managers during those periods. One thing that we haven't talked about here is climate change, and I think even Dr. Anderson, who is relied upon by the proponents, has admitted that in the future we can expect lower summer river flows in the Columbia as a result of climate change. The Independent Scientific Advisory Board that is relied upon by many agencies has concluded the same and has said that Oregon is at risk of losing about 40%, up to 40% of its salmon and trout habitat in the Columbia Basin by the end of this century, primarily due to higher temperatures and lower stream flows. As a final point, there's a lot of talk about annual volumetric flows on the Columbia, how much water is discharged at the mouth, how much water exists at the dalles. Those numbers are basically irrelevant from a fisheries management perspective. What matters is the real-time flow in the dry season or at the time-critical times for migrating fish. And, in fact, the Columbia River in 2001 got as low as about 156,000 acre-feet per second in the John Day section of the river, and that's a lot different than 198 million acre-feet that discharges at the mouth. When Washington was proposing some withdrawals that were slightly larger than what's being proposed in this bill, the NRC report concluded that as to those low July flows, this withdrawal could take roughly 16 to 21% of Columbia River minimum flows during those July low flow events. If you factor in for the difference in acre feet between the two proposals, you're talking around somewhere like 8 to 10% of those low flows. That's a significant hit to the river, and we believe that the current collaborative approach is the better way to go to solve the basin's problems. Thank you.
Thank you.
For the record. Chair Cannon, committee members, my name is Tom Wolf. I'm the chair of the Oregon Council of Trout Unlimited, representing the 3,000 members of Trout Unlimited here in the state. I'll be very brief, as you asked, and not go as long as my learned colleague on my right went. Just real quick, Oregon Council of Trout Unlimited opposes this House bill for many of the reasons stated by John DeVoe of WaterWatch. Just one thing I'd like to add is it was noted before that by ODFW that these withdrawals could have detrimental effects on listed fish. It also, we are about to have this year 300,000 spring Chinook return to the upper Columbia River Snake Basin, which will be, as I noted, the second largest return of spring Chinook in the last 50 years. Now, both commercially and recreationally, catching those fish brings millions of dollars to the economy of Oregon and Washington for recreational fishermen, for the commercial fishermen down in Astoria, for hotels, for restaurants. And I think we have to be careful about any act of taking water out of the upper Columbia that could have a detrimental effect on not only the listed fish, but the great economic impact of healthy runs like that spring Chinook. I think that we'll have to listen to the learned advice of our agency charged with protecting our fish and wildlife, ODFW, with NOAA Fisheries, and not just depend on a single report coming from somebody in Washington. So I think that we have to be very careful about that, and so that not only will this bill affect listed fish, but it will affect great economic benefits for many Oregonians. Thank you.
Thank you.
Tom? Chair Cannon and members of the committee, my name is Tom Smoot. I'm the Association of Northwest Steelheaders president. And I have before me a letter written by our resource director, and I'd like to read into the record. He says, "My name is Doug Hunt, and I am the volunteer resource director for the Association of Northwest Steelheaders. We have 17 chapters located around the state and over 2,000 members. As an association, our priorities are to advance sports fishing opportunity and improve salmon and steel habitat for the future and future generations. Oregon has made tremendous investments in salmon recovery. We have passed Measure 66 to provide a dedicated source of refund revenue to fund salmon restoration projects. We have made significant management changes to curtail sports and commercial harvest. And at the Northwest Steelheaders support and are helping implement reforms to our hatchery system to minimize interaction between wild and hatchery fish. Our association leadership considered House Bill 2406 and concluded that the risks far outweigh the benefits. We are opposed to withdrawing 132,000 acre-feet of water from the Columbia River during the summer months. This is an important period of time when salmon and steelhead smolt are migrating to the ocean, and we should not compromise their journey with new water withdrawals that have not been closely scrutinized. Please oppose passage of House Bill 2406. Thank you for your consideration."
Thank you. Before we bring up our last witness or two and acknowledging once again the graciousness of our remaining members who are staying to the very end, any quick questions for this panel? Thank you very much for being here. So Dave Moskowitz and Bill Kludian called you earlier. If you want to come up or submit written testimony that we'll take with us either way. Go ahead, Dave.
Thank you. Chair Cannon, members of the committee, my name is David Moskowitz, and today I'm speaking on behalf of the Native Fish Society. I appreciate your willingness to stay late today and to give everyone the opportunity to speak to this matter. I've submitted written testimony. I'm going to make 3 points. The proponents talked about their expert, Mr. Anderson, a PhD in fishy matters, as presenting a or meeting the burden of what the impacts might be to fish. And if any of you were around in 2007, some very non-expert fish folks, your colleagues, Senator Bruce Starr and Senator Ryan Deckert, asked basic simple questions of Dr. Anderson about the effects of the proposal on salmon and steelhead survival, and he could not answer them. I don't think the proponents have met their burden about the effects of this proposal on fish, and you can probably still listen to that exchange from 2007. It's in the archives. Secondly, and I worked on this issue in the early 1990s, the whole entire Columbia Basin worked in a painstaking process to figure out who was going to use water from the Columbia, where and when. This was after the listings of salmon and the Northwest Power Plant Council and the Bonneville Power Administration, together with four states, four Native American tribes, and multiple stakeholders from those four states and nations, tried to set a reasonable balance. It was a tortured negotiation. Reservoirs were drained in Idaho and Montana for the benefit of fish, for navigation, for irrigation. And the fish took a very close margin in that negotiation. The fish were given just enough water in that negotiation in the early 1990s. And it was painstaking. There was a lot of very smart people who worked on that. There were a lot of compromises made, all sides, whether you're a recreationalist, an irrigation person, a municipal water user, or the fish, or a fisherman. Everybody gave up a lot in that negotiation in the 1990s. And finally, I'd just like to say, and this is now the second session where we've addressed this bill, but this proposal sets a dangerous precedent for the legislature. Western water law is administered by the states, and every state has a water resources department of some sort, and Washington's Department of Ecology. They have a process set up that honors a couple hundred years of water law in the West, and that when you want water, you approach the relevant state agency and you say, I'd like to use an amount of water on this land. This bill casts that asunder, and that means that if you pass this bill, it means that any entity, perhaps it's an irrigation district in your district, Representative Gillum, or in yours, Representative Jensen, any entity that doesn't want to go through the process can hire an all-star lobby crew and circumvent existing law. If the legislature would like to be a super water resources commission, heading down this path of adoption will take you there. I appreciate the time to talk about this issue. It means a lot to our organization and our members, and I'm happy to take any questions.
Thanks, Dave. Let's hear from Bill.
Thank you, Chair Cannon. Committee for the record, Bill Cluding, Carpenters Industrial Council. I'll make this real short. Chair Cannon, Representative Jensen made a very, very good point when asked, who is this going to benefit? I walk these halls every day, and my main purpose is creating jobs. This bill will create jobs. It will benefit this state. If Oregon needs anything today, it's jobs. We've crippled ourselves in the last 25 years to where we need good jobs. Representative Boone, you made a very good point for food. It won't be long. Southern California, the breadbasket of this United States, is going to be out of water. They know it. There's nothing they can do about it. They would love to trade us places. When they are not able to irrigate their farm ground, they're going to look at us. Hopefully, we have every acre of farm ground ready to go, because we're going to need it. Representative Smith, you made a good point when you asked for a multiplier effect. And I'll say this real shortly. Just look across the river, what it done for that side. Look at those thriving communities. Look at the thousands and thousands of jobs that go across the river for one simple thing. they got water. Thank you.
Thank you. Questions? Great. Well, I appreciate all the testimony we heard today. We have also, for the record, a letter from the Governor's Natural Resources Policy Director, Mike Carrier, a letter from the Oregon Wheat Growers, letters from the League of Women Voters, as well as the Cattlemen's Association. I've asked Representative Smith and Jensen to help take next steps here, to put their heads together and propose some next steps to the committee. I mean, clearly there's an acute need in the Umatilla. I think everybody agrees with that assessment, and there's real opportunity in the basin. It's been really heartening, having been somewhat involved in 1069, to see the broad consensus that has developed around this aquifer recharge proposal. It brings a lot of stakeholders together, and I'm hopeful that whatever we do this session can help build on that success. So Representative Jensen and Smith will be talking and probably talking with many of you about moving forward on this proposal. Thanks. Representative Jensen.
I gather from your way you phrased that, that this was not a request on your part.
yeah.
But
your use of the past tense was interesting as well.
Let me assure you that I'd be very happy to work with Representative Smith. I'd be very proud to do that, to work with somebody that has his background and skill and ability on this particular issue. So,
great. Thank you.
Likewise, Mr. Chair.
Thank you.
Honored to do it.
Super. With that, I'll close the public hearing on House Bill 2406 and close the House Committee on the Environment and Water.